You're listening to Germ Warfare with Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. Yeah, something that's been bugging me lately is this idea of rights. Oh, I know I'm gonna trigger some people. I'm gonna ruffle some feathers here, but that's not deliberate. It's something that I genuinely have been thinking about. I sometimes wonder if we just have too many rights in general. I mean, this idea of rights, it's my right, it's my right. And every time I hear that, the first thing that pops into my head is I'm entitled. And it seems to push this idea that entitlement is okay. And what it does is that it removes the need for common decency, for just being a good, kind person. You know, I might be driving my car there's nowhere else I can go other than the road. And somebody might be walking across the road really slowly. Now, the decent thing to do there would be for that person to walk quicker, because I can go nowhere else. But what happens in today's sort of modern zeitgeist is that it's my right, I can walk here, and I'll walk as slow as I want. And it creates this weird kind of God complex, like, I'm more important than you. Who are you to tell me what to do? And at the very fundamental level, I have this sensation of rights being overplayed. And I'm trying to gather my thoughts. But let me give you an example. If I'm walking on the beach and I'm the only person on the beach, and there's somebody swimming in the ocean and they're clearly drowning. Now, the law of the land is that that person has a right to life. So what does that mean? If I decide that, no, it's too dangerous for me to go out into the water because I'm going to drown too. So I perhaps, and I don't have my phone with me or whatever, so I decide to head back to my car, and that person drowns. Well, what was the point of the right to life? Nobody was acting on that, and that person didn't survive. Yes, another thought. The idea of a right to clean water, okay? Okay, so now what does that mean? So if you live in an area where there isn't clean water and you make the claim, well, I have a right to clean water, essentially what you're saying is that I'm outsourcing the infrastructural development. So other people must use their tax money to pay for infrastructure, for piping, and for water to be filtered to that area. That's essentially what it means. In a weird kind of way, rights are a way of outsourcing responsibility to other people. And I'm not entirely certain if having many rights actually leads to a prosperous, harmonious society. I'm noticing more and more that there just seems to be more and more conflict based on, well, it's my right, well, it's my right, well, it's my right, well, it's my right. And then we have to go to court, you know, or we have to go to a lawyer or some sort of legal authority. And again, this is outsourcing. You know, there's no need to just take responsibility and sort out what that grievance might be. Anyway, I'm just having a bit of a rant. Let me just quickly tell you, download the TNT app from the Android store or from the apps from the Apple store, at least, so that if you are not able to listen to my show or any other show live, you can always listen to it after the fact. I'm very excited to get to my guest. My name is Jim. This is TNT Radio.
Conversations to inform and include.
It's meant for everyday people to understand.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Eric Coppolino, I hope I pronounced your surname correctly. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Good morning. Welcome. Thank you.
Did I get your surname correct?
Yes, correct. Yeah, Eric Francis Coppolino, depending on who knows me and when.
I've never heard that surname before. What is its origin?
Coppolino is Sicilian, and it's a very snappy kind of a hat. It's like a fedora, but more stylish. And it's hard to find a picture of it.
Well, I'm a fan already. I do like stuff that's slightly more stylish.
Yes, it's interesting. One time I saw a picture of it, and I'm sure there's one last 90-year-old Italian milliner in New York City, but I haven't found him yet.
I must say, I do love your style. You've got pink glasses. Is that right?
I wear tinted reading glasses. It little cool warms up the screen a little bit and cools off my eyes a little bit.
I'm chatting to you because I watched the most fascinating conversation between you and Sam Bailey not too long ago. And I want to chat to you about pretty much what you spoke about with her. But before I do that, for those who don't know who you are, what is your background?
It's a kind of a dual background. From a very young age, I started doing investigative reporting of fraud related to toxins. Fraud by government entities and private entities both. It's always a public-private partnership when people are poisoned. And of course, there is no right, as you're implying in your warm-up, there's no right enumerated to clean land, so clean anything. So then it comes down to who did what and when, under what authority. But in any event, I've done a lot of investigative journalism around the behavior of companies like Monsanto, General Electric, Westinghouse, and then federal government and state government agencies that are supposed to be regulating them to keep a handle on their activities. And then in the mid-1990s, I decided to bring my spiritual endeavors to the front of my professional life, and I started writing a horoscope column, which was kind of an interesting switch to go from the front page to the horoscope page, but I did. And then soon after that, I started doing the astrology of news events. So I'm one of the world's foremost news astrologers because I have many, many decades, four decades of experience covering governments and companies and, basically public policy, and then started doing the charts of these events as a qualified astrologer. So I've developed a whole genre of news astrology.
And how did that lead you to where you are now, where you're going to be chatting about digital?
Well, along the way, I have a person of fairly eclectic interests, and along the way, well, my father is a PhD in media studies. And so I grew up with a lot of dinner time conversation about media theory, and which is not the normal thing that American kids talk about at the dinner table. But it was divorce weekend. I would get some of the content of university lectures in the car driving around with my brother and my dad. So I've always taken an interest in the work of Marshall McLuhan. A philosopher who lived, I think he was born, I don't know his dates, but Marshall died in 1980 at about the age of 71, I think. I've always taken an interest in his work, and I've understood some of the implications of his work. And then one day I mentioned him on my Facebook page, and this kid, Andrew McLuhan, shows up and starts commenting. And I thought, well, that's an interesting coincidence. But it turned out to be his grandson. And so this was about six or seven years ago, maybe around 2015. And so I began a kind of a collaboration with Andrew, and we set the goal of figuring out the internet. McLuhan's theories involve understanding the impact of media on people. In other words, not what's transported by our conversation on Zoom, but rather the effect of Zoom itself. What is the effect of the digital framework? What is the effect of translating my body into time and space at the speed of light, which is what we're doing now, as opposed to you and I sitting in the room having this conversation? It has a completely different, it is a different definition of an experience of what it means to be a person when you are broadcast at the speed of light. Humans are not supposed to be in two places at once in the, on this plane of reality. But we do. We've invented this technology. And so all of these, going back to print, all these technologies completely transform consciousness. They change the concept of what a person is. They change our idea of who we are and what we are, following along here. And so the study, media studies, is not just the study of the typewriter makes typing neat, right? You would think, oh, what was the impact of the typewriter? Oh, it was typed letters. So this is a good example, one of my favorites. The impact of the typewriter was suddenly there were jobs for armies of young women who showed up in the cities as typists. And it created a whole sub-economy allowing women to live in urban environments independently. Now, you wouldn't think that would be an effect of the typewriter, but it was, in fact, an effect of the typewriter, regardless of what was typed. And all media have this effect on it.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful to read it.
Actually.
It's really cool. The book is called, let's see if I've got a copy of it here. Well, so we're really on the radio, so you can see it. Please attest to the fact that I'm holding the book up.
Yes, Understanding Media. Yes, I can see the book, and I'm going.
It's Understanding Media by Marshall McLuhan, published 1964, the year that I was born. And it's a little dense for today's kind of Twitter oriented readers, but worth sitting with a pencil and reading it. It will transform your view of the world, and you'll suddenly have a new understanding of clothing and car tires and the telephone. And he only alludes to computers. And so Andrew and I and his dad, and I learned a lot from them, a lot from his dad. One quote in particular put the whole thing into focus for me. What the impact of computing technology, of digital technology, is on society, how it has transformed society. And it's had the impact of yes, you following me? Now, digital is an extension of electricity because we're working in electricity right now. And so electricity is what gives you light speed movement of information. Electricity is what creates the out-of-body effect, therefore, because you're projected out-of-body when you're flying across the ocean on the telephone. And digital electrical technology creates a tribal environment. It starts to de-individualize people who were finally de-tribalized by print technology. So even as early as ancient Greece, the alphabet was having a de-tribalizing effect and converting people into more individual thinking, internally focused people with an inner life that had nothing to do with the tribe. And this went on, this developed almost unfettered for two centuries until the telegraph, followed by radio, followed by the telephone, and these things have all had the effect of turning us back into tribal beings, basically. So there's a lot of different effects, but that's one of the most important transformative effects. And so when we talk about the impact of media, it's not just what's conveyed by that media. What any one book is about is much less significant than the impact of the book itself as a technological device.
And that's very interesting. So like you mentioned Zoom. That's what everybody uses. What impact then are you suggesting it has had, just the presence of Zoom?
Well, I mean, Zoom is an extension of many other technologies that existed before. It's kind of a glorified version of Skype, and I forget there was one or two other type of platforms like this ahead of it. But what we're doing, first of all, we're on three different continents right now, so that's kind of crazy, and we are existing simultaneously on those three continents. You'd have to look at things like the impact of the high resolution video as a thing, as opposed to low resolution video. One of the effects of Zoom is to compel participation. That's an effect of digital, but Zoom makes it really easy to bring people from all over the place together in a format where they are participating. The internet in general does that as well. So digital technology has a number of different impacts, remembering that most of them are extensions of what all electricity does. Tribalizing removes privacy, pushes us out of body. But those are the three main ones. Mm. So we're kind of in this phantom format here.
Yeah, Eric, I've got so many questions for you, but quickly I need to go to an ad break.
Go for it.
Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
This has been an insane week news-wise for me, in my world, in the world of climate, energy, agriculture, and great reset issues. This week, we had multiple things happening at once, and they were the Netherlands protests continuing with the farmers there protesting, the port-mandated net zero emission rules regulated for the nitrogen emissions. And what we're finding out is Netherlands is the second largest food production, first, the Europe's largest meat exporter. And this agenda that they're pushing is literally going to dismantle, bankrupt, and close down small family-run farms that have been in existence for generations and families. And this is happening to the country that's responsible for the most meat exports.
The Mark Morano Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The 2020 election was the most secure in U.S. history. There has been no evidence of widespread voter fraud. He lost a fair and secure election. Most secure
election in American history.
Really?
All those of you who volunteered and worked the polls, you deserve a special thanks from the entire nation.
This one mule made 53 trips to 20 drop boxes. He's not alone. We tracked 2,000 mules making multiple ballot drops. Leaving no fingerprints. Snapping photos to get paid. A coordinated ring of illegal vote harvesting in all the key states where the election was decided.
They've delivered us a clear victory.
Game over.
Stream It's Salem Now or Locals.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Oh.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Eric, I must be honest. What you're saying is actually very, very interesting. And I want to go back to a couple points that you were making, because I haven't really actually thought about what you're saying until now, hearing you speak. And I'm starting to suddenly realize that just, for example, the internet, if I'm following correctly, it's changing the fabric of reality.
Yeah.
Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. It's changing everything about the fabric of everything, most particularly what a person thinks a person is and what we think we are and how we experience our reality. I mean, for one thing, pursue your line of questioning if you want. But just to give one example, the phone here, which I set this morning so I could wake up and not miss this. This contains memories, right? We outsource thought, memory, navigation of the world. We take part of our brain, a large part of our brain, and assign it to this thing. not finding out how to get around town yourself. Instead, we have a disembodied voice telling us how to get places. This completely changes...
Is that not just a normal... Sorry, go on.
No, no, what's... Please.
Well, I was going to ask you, is that just not a normal progression of our own existence? I mean, is it a bad thing? Was it a good thing? Or was it just a thing?
Well, it's just a thing. But when we get into COVID and we talk about what that thing did, what was able to happen because we had been so weakened and so transformed and our self-concept and individuality so stripped from us, and the idea of what it means to be a person so reduced down to a set of algorithms and scripts, right? Because while we work these things, we are becoming like them. We're behaving in a way that is appropriate for the device. When you're on the phone with your bank and you have to talk to one of those stupid AI voices that's not an operator because it's 1/99th cheaper to have an AI voice than it is to have someone sitting there helping you, we're being conditioned to behave in a way appropriate to that environment. And that transforms us. And every one of these little interactions changes us and makes us behave more and more like the thing we're using to suit the thing that we're using. And then this, in turn, has an effect on every individual and the entire society, including people who are not affected, who don't even have one of these. People who are sitting in apartments in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, who are 90 years old, who've never touched a cell phone or a smartphone, are still impacted by the transformation of people and society by the prevailing technology. And one of the effects of the prevailing... So when COVID is launched, it is launched into a society of people who have been so disembodied that, first of all, and so numbed out. So one of the effects of any extension of the nervous system, which is what this is, right? This microphone is an extension of your ear. So somehow your ear has made it all the way into my studio. I mean, that's incredible. You're 5,000 miles away. So that what impact does that really have? Well, most people are not measuring this. Most people don't know it. And yes, it is the normal progression of society as directed by marketing technologists who have no interest other than pushing the next innovation and making money. They're not thinking about the effects of what they're doing. Most likely, though Jobs was more aware of it than Gates initially, it sounds like Steve Jobs had read McLuhan from his early interviews about the impact of media. Gates, it seems, stumbled upon it and he realized what he had done. But in any event, COVID comes along, people are weakened, they're out of their body, they're numbed out, they're cut off. And so one of the things that was the network was used for was to send a jolt of fear, of terror through the world population. And my assessment is that people were so unaccustomed to feeling anything at all, because there's no feeling in this realm. There's no pheromones, there's no actual nuance, that when a jolt of fear was sent across the network over and over and over again and people felt it, they decided that it was real because they felt something. They felt something.
Yes.
Finally a feeling. And so that became real. And it was, and they were, and feeling is compelling. People, whatever they're feeling, they generally want to keep feeling it, even negative feelings. And so this was used to basically reel people in and control them completely. And then...
But what's interesting... Sorry, I keep interrupting.
No, go ahead.
Please
do.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm following your thinking, and it's so fascinating. So, but the other aspect about the COVID story... Now, I personally don't believe that SARS-CoV-2 is anything real. I believe it was just a sequence that was done digitally, and that digital interpretation is what put the whole world into fear. which is precisely what you're saying.
Yes. Well, it was their rationale. They were able to say we have a virus because they did a bunch of AI magic tricks. And they took a bunch of, they swept up the floor of the grocery store and they threw it into a computer and they said, look, we have a grapefruit. That's not a grapefruit. So SARS-CoV-2 does not exist in the sense of, ooh, they found a grapefruit and sequenced it. Let's go find another one. SARS-CoV-2 only exists in what are called metagenomic transcripts, which are basically made up sequences, which are not really sequences. They're transcripts of artificially intelligence modeled computer code. And then they design a so-called test based on that. And then they go looking for computer code in people. And if they find a match at cycle threshold 45, which is ridiculous, they have to push this thing. They have to fly to the moon in a Ford Pinto to do this. Then they claim that someone has an infection. But most people are not interested in that. I've been teaching this now for 2.5 years, trying to explain this issue of the in silico sequence and how this thing is never found. It was only constructed in a computer model. You're exactly right. It only exists as a computer model. But then they come along with their computer code vaccine, the mRNA vaccine, and basically do what Bill Gates has been doing to us all for the past 30 years, saying, we'll upgrade you and you'll be fine. Don't worry. We'll just give you some of this genetic code correction, and then you'll be safe from this new computer virus, basically. And people believe it because we're so, first of all, terrified, and then second, we are so conditioned to think like computers, like everything is a computer. Even the words "the Great Reset" are evocative of restarting a computer. You know, you push the button and it restarts. That's how they're thinking. They should call it the Great Restart, but it's not a reset or a restart, but the metaphor is there. And so your mRNA upgrade, you're restarting the computer of capitalism, and many other things model humans as a computer. And this is transhumanism. We think that transhumanism is getting a chip.
Yes.
A chip shoved in your brain. No. Transhumanism starts when you're talking to Siri in a way that you think she's going to understand. And you start talking Siri code or Google code. And you start typing in these kind of crude constructions. You completely fracture grammar and thought. And you're just going to type into the computer the way you think is going to get the best result. We're being conditioned to be like them more than they're being conditioned to be like us.
Jeez. Okay, Eric, don't go anywhere. I quickly have to go to news headlines.
With a quick check of the day's headlines, I'm Darren Metzer. The Indian parliament and government officials have voted overwhelmingly in favor of electing a 64-year-old former school teacher as the country's next president. Italy is facing a general election after President Sergio Mattarella dissolved parliament on Thursday, hours after the country's prime minister quit. An election must now be held within the next 70 days. And Russia and Ukraine were expected to sign a deal on Friday to resume grain exports through the Black Sea.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Eric, you mentioned the word transhumanism. There's a term that is not really in the zeitgeist yet.
No, it's not, and it's controversial. What it means is people becoming, it's the merging of computer and human reality, as I understand it to be. And most people see this as being the chip, but I don't see it as being the chip. I see it as everything associated with the way that humans are responding, their behavior toward technology. It all starts there. The training starts there. It starts at the beginning. Right.
How old then is the concept of transhumanism?
Oh, man. I would say that it's probably as old as Turing. It's old as the inventor of the algorithm for whom the Turing test is named. The Turing test would be, I have to determine whether you're an algorithm or a real person. And I'm at the end of this discussion, I have to argue one way or the other. That's the Turing test. Can you, if you or Nancy is an algorithm, can you convince me that you're human, and can you fool a human? So Turing was the inventor of the computer, and his first big project was cracking the Nazi code, the Enigma machine, the Heydrich Enigma. And so this couldn't be done with human thought wasn't fast enough or able to run enough of the possibilities simultaneously quickly enough. And so probably would have taken centuries. So Turing invents algorithms that are able to do it, to do it. And he also invents the Turing test. And so here is the moment that AI is used to take over human thought in any form. We're into transhumanism. All artificial intelligence is transhumanism. Right? You have to go back to the beginning. You have to go back to the earliest iteration, the earliest emergence of the concept when a person delegated thinking to a device that was working in binary.
Wow.
In my view.
That is scary.
So it's going on for a while.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking now as you're talking, how dumbed down people seem to be becoming as a result.
Well, think of it as a haze. I think the dumbed down is partly, it's partly the result of things being shrunken into words, you know, 50 words or whatever. But it's also the amputation effect. For most people, this is too intense. To transmit your thoughts and the image of your body over thousands and thousands of miles all the time, to have access to all information all the time, to have to sort out things you never had to sort out. People are now walking around with the capacity of, I mean, if anyone who knows video technology knows that this required two men to carry it around. In 1980, 85, 1990, the Minicam was set up on a tripod with a battery pack weighing 50 pounds, and now you can just slip it in your suit pocket. And all of this is overwhelming to people. All this capacity is overwhelming to people. And what the natural response is that they amputate their senses. They amputate their sensitivity and cut themselves off, and that creates the digital haze, in my view. It's not mere stupidity. It's more of a stupor. It's more of a, the dumbing down is a sensory and mental truncation because it's so much.
If we go back, if we go back to COVID, you were talking about the in silico process. A lot of people haven't heard that term. I know what the term means, but would you mind just breaking that apart again, just so that we can understand where we're at?
Yeah, well, my understanding is that we have a concept of what genetic sequencing is. You take a grapefruit and you slice it up into really little tiny slices, mainly genetic code, and you've sequenced the grapefruit. What was done with SARS-CoV-2 was, instead of having a grapefruit to sequence, which they didn't have, they don't have any patient samples, they swept the floor of the produce department. And they took the combined residue of all vegetables that have been there for however long the produce department was in business and all the people who walked through and all the dust they brought in from the street, and they threw that into a computer, into a metagenomics program, and they made a metagenomic transcript of what they think a grapefruit might be like. So this is what they did with COVID. They swept the floor, i.e. a patient swab out of their nose combined with monkey cells, combined with calf cells, combined with cancer cells, combined with antibiotics and poisons and culture food, and they called it a culture, and they crumbled all that DNA, RNA, into kind of one thing that was then reassembled by a metagenomics program into an in silico theoretical sequence of a virus, not a virus. It is no more a virus than the sweepings of a grocery store are a grapefruit. And then they take that phony sweep, they take those sweepings and they look for a little piece of that based on their computer model. They convert that into the primers for the PCR, the test being used to do all this manipulation. And if you're, if something from your body matches something swept off the floor of the grocery store, then you're said to have COVID.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. You have to use metaphors here, but that's one that I think works pretty good. I mean, it's also a little like saying if you have a dollar in your pocket, you're a bank robber because there's dollars in banks. There's no, it's so ridiculous that you it's hard to even express it. And further, there, the government documents about the test all say this. They all say expressly that this is not a test for infection. It does not work to test for infection. It merely is finding molecules of what they don't tell you are made up theoretical viruses that don't exist in nature.
That's what Kerry Mullis said, and nobody seems to care. I mean, he invented it.
Yeah, he said this a lot of times. He felt pretty bad about what it was being used to do, and he seemed to me spent much of his adult life after inventing the PCR and winning the Nobel Prize explaining the danger of this thing. And the danger is widely known. CDC documents explain the danger. The manufacturer's documents explain the danger. The New York Times reported in January 2007. It's caused numerous false outbreaks. They went into this crisis knowing that their PCR could create 100% false positives if you believe there's any positives. Let's pretend there are positives. But they knew going into this that they could get 100% false positives. So then they took this magical machine that creates epidemics and put it to work for COVID.
And it's that could do this for anything.
Pardon?
They could do it for anything.
Yes. Yeah, they could do it for anything. Well, they're trying with monkeypox. That does not exist either. They tried it with HIV. That doesn't exist either.
That does not exist.
Mm. No, it exists in this conceptual metagenomic sense of existence, but that's not existence. It's a phantom. It's a notion. It's a concept. It's not a thing.
Yeah.
And it would be fine if they said,
like,
well,
basically what you're saying.
Yes.
Mm. No, sorry. Go on.
It would be fine if they said, oh, it's a concept. It's theoretical. It's like dark matter. We don't really know if it's there, but that's the best explanation of what we have. If they said that with COVID, it's the best explanation of what we have, then people would go looking for other explanations, like, is there community spread? Are these symptoms consistent? Blah, blah, blah. And they'd find out that none of that held up either. But instead they said, no, we've got it. What, you got to go to break?
No. I just keep saying, I keep interrupting you. I don't mean to, but I...
not at all. I'm from New York. You guys are way too polite. I'm from New York where we like bash into each other and totally friendly conversation.
What I was saying is in my head, I picture it like this. It's a virus that's on a computer, right? And that's why you have an antivirus. That concept somehow became reality.
Yeah, it's a pretty good way to say it. It became reality in the sense that people were convinced that it was reality, like we all love R2-D2. But there is no R2-D2. But who doesn't love R2-D2? So it's a fiction. But this is a very pernicious fiction. This is a fiction that was completely used against us and anchored with terror. It was anchored with anxiety. And then they said, we alone have the cure to your anxiety, the shot. Everyone line up for your death jab. It's outrageous. But the problem is that the effects of the environment and the environment itself are often invisible to people. I am finding it satisfying that people are interested in this concept of the impact of digital and COVID as a digital phenomenon. You know, and COVID as a digital phenomenon works two ways. The obvious way is that the metagenomic transcription is digital, the PCR is digital, the result is digital, the news is delivered digitally. It's a very different world to have, this thing feeding you 24/7 instead of just watching the 5 o'clock news once a day, right? That's what we used to do. We used to watch the 5 o'clock news, and that was it. That was the news. Thank you very much. It started as a 15-minute program. They had to expand it to half an hour at some point. But now we're infused directly all the time with all this information that is itself created by computers. That's the obvious part. The less obvious part is how we've been transformed, weakened, and made ready for this from decades of exposure and conditioning. And decades of exposure and conditioning to computing devices and behaving in ways that are appropriate for them and not for the human world. So they took their digital assault and they launched it at a time when people were particularly vulnerable to a digital assault because they had been transformed by the digital environment. That's why you couldn't have COVID at the Woodstock Festival in 1969. No one cared. Mm. They all just piled in. A lot of people had heard of it. It was on page one of the New York Times right before the festival saying 100,000 people had been killed in the United States. And then there was a festival and 500,000 kids, 400,000 or something, showed up in a farmer's field made of cow manure in a rainy weekend. Talk about, oh, you're going to catch cold. Let's see. There's the Hong Kong flu going around and y'all are going to sit out in a cool, damp, upstate New York weekend without blankets in a pile of cow shit. Well, why did that happen in 1969? But in 2020, people are sitting in parks in little circles made out of chalk, staying away from each other. And they take seriously, you have to walk in a one-way aisle of the supermarket. That's one of my favorite of all times, is the one-way aisle of the supermarket. That's even better than social distancing. It's better than the person who flips their mask up when you walk by, as if the guy standing there 5 minutes before you got there wasn't spewing out coronas all over the damn place. No, the circles in the park are just perfect, and that's digital. You're in your pixel. And then but think of how cut off from reality you have to be to think that a one-way supermarket aisle means something.
Eric, don't go anywhere. We're going to do our last ad rotation.
Misty Winston on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The Ohio Supreme Court threw out the state's GOP-drawn congressional map on Tuesday and ordered state lawmakers to redraw the districts ahead of the 2024 elections. In the 4-3 ruling, the court said that the evidence presented shows that the March 2nd plan unduly favors the Republican Party and unduly disfavors the Democratic Party, which is a violation of the state constitution's anti-gerrymandering provision. Ohio lawmakers now have 30 days to draw up a new map, or the Ohio Redistricting Commission will have 30 days to adopt a new congressional map. This is the second time the Supreme Court has tossed out the map for being unconstitutional. The new map will not be used until 2024, as the 2022 primaries were already held under the current congressional lines. Ohio has long been seen as one of the most heavily gerrymandered states, so it'll be interesting to watch this play out. This is Misty Winston for TNT Radio.
In many countries around the world, medical care is scarce. Countless millions have no access to safe surgery. Mercy Ships is there to help. Mercy Ships provides free surgeries for the thousands of those who are waiting for surgery at each port.
Mercy Ships is bringing services to countries that would otherwise never be able to access those services.
Find out how you can help by visiting our website at mercyships.org. That's mercyships.org.
There's no dispute. The jabs are not safe or effective. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
You know, what's interesting, Eric, is I've had, as probably you, many conversations over the last 2.5 years or so saying, you know, there's no evidence that this microbe, this deadly zombie microbe that's flying around the world is real. Oh, yes, there is. Look, yes, the science that shows it. And there in every single paper, you see this term in silico. And it just reinforces the idea that people are confusing digital interpretations or algorithms with reality. It's precisely what you're saying.
Yeah. Yes, and people are exploiting that as well. People are confused, but they're exploiting. The people arguing for the existence of viruses are confusing two very different things. They're confusing the grapefruit with the dust on the floor of the grocery store. But this is about fear. This is not about grapefruit juice. So there's a lot playing into this, right? There's a lot of agony involved and people cut off from their own humanity. By the way, the disembodiment thing It's, I think, one of the most frightening things, because when people are in a disembodied state, violence feels good to them because it helps them figure out who they are. And so the aggression was, in a sense, self-affirming. The aggression of COVID itself, in other words, the aggression of the governments and the technologists was satisfying to people because it helped them have a kind of a false memory of who they are. And then all the action in society was aggressive. All the distancing measures and the blatant hostility and excluding people from the table allowed an eruption of rage. And what this took hold because people are already so alienated from who they are that the expressions of the rage and the pain caused by the rage flying in all directions serve to be affirming rather than de-affirming of humanity. Oh, I'm a person. I know who I am. You're my son. You haven't had the jab. I'm not letting you come to dinner. It's a complete inversion of reality, but you can see how it can work as an emotional hook, as a kind of a cocaine for people who are having a very hard time identifying who they are.
Where do you see this going?
Oh, well, it really all depends on if people wake up to this. And I'm not that optimistic about that, because every other time anything like this has happened, people have not shown an interest in waking up. We're about to enter a phase where the transhumanism is going to be turned up. This, I think, was all kind of a trial run, and we're going to learn a lot. There'll be two. This is now me speaking as an astrologer. That there are going to be two main clusters of events. One of them in October, late October, and then another one in March of 2023. And I think that, what can I tell you? I mean, if there are more extreme events, people are almost as likely to respond in mass panic as they did during early COVID. I'm not that optimistic. I think we have to stick with the awake, have to stick together and do our best to fulfill our dharma on this planet. We have to be thinking in a much... What's that?
How?
By doing the work we came here to do, by treating each other with respect, by seeking real understanding, by not listening to tyrants, staying close to your original purpose. We have forgotten that. One of the things we've been conned out of in all of this is original purpose. Look at all the holistic healers who suddenly started going for the virus and the jab. So
they lost that.
Yeah, 95% of them, it seems, went over the falls. So we're going to have to live this out. I mean, really, there's no other planet that we can test on, that we can experiment on. I think that other planets have come to this brink, and other societies and our planets have come to this brink where we become the product of our technology rather than our technology being the product of who we are. All we can really do is go through it. It is possible there can be some group initiation. It is possible that people will that a small minority of people will agree to something. It's really only a small minority that ever runs the show anyway. But I don't think we're aware of our predicament for the most part. I don't think we understand is that you're the fly in the web, the fly in the web ad. I'm not sure we realize that we're flies in this web, caught in this web, rather than using it creatively. Now, one of the things that McLuhan says almost on every page of his writing is that the antidote to all of this technological numb out and disembodiment is to be an artist, is to stay completely creatively connected to what you're doing and to use your tools creatively rather than have them shape you in an uncreative and kind of consumeristic way. We need to read more. We need to be more in touch with nature. We need to be more in touch with ourselves. Essentially, we need we need the kind of spiritual paths that were being advocated in the 1950s and 1960s, moving to a simpler life, of moving in the direction of respecting our brothers and sisters, a little more putting daisies inside the muzzles of rifles rather than throwing rocks at National Guardsmen and soldiers. I wonder if we're up to it. I mean, in some ways, it's getting to be a lonely world. In other ways, the people who don't respect themselves and humanity are making themselves known. And then we get to meet through this. We who are on a very similar mission, working in similar ways, using the internet in similar ways, have been able to find each other. We need to do a lot more of this and learn how to work in functional forms of consensus by agreeing on the underlying values. We are vulnerable to another series of attacks.
But it is a bit scary, though. I mean, when you see people like Mark Zuckerberg actively pushing a digital reality.
Oh, yeah. But look, the thing is that's ahead of... We are often living in the technological world of 10 years in the future. And so we are living in the world of artificial and enhanced reality right now. People assume their life is like these TV shows. Yes. So you don't really need Meta and the metaverse when you look outside and half the people walking down the streets are staring into their phones. I mean, I had a moment of awakening when I was caught in traffic on 8th Avenue in New York City before COVID. And I mean, 8th Avenue is like six lanes wide. It is dangerous. And this person was walking across the street, looking at their phone, not looking at the traffic. So that's unreal. Complete detachment. Now you multiply that by a few billion and you find out where we are. I don't know the way back except to teach the things I teach and do the things I do and to present in the ways that I've always presented, because I've seen these problems in existence much of my life. You know, the cutoff from nature and from humanity and all of that. And now it's just grown to this heightened, almost apocalyptic scale.
Mm.
More discussions like this will help.
Yeah, definitely.
So, what else can I tell you?
Eric, yeah, we've got about 3 minutes left. And unfortunately, time is not on our side. So, Let's wind down and talk about where I might find you.
Planetwaves.fm. Real simple. Planetwaves.fm. That'll get you. That'll link you through to all of my projects. Did that come across clearly? I was jumping a little bit.
No, it came across perfectly clearly.
Fabulous. So you'll find my chronology. One of my projects is I maintain the I'm kind of the COVID daykeeper, where I've got the daily chronology of COVID. It's up to the present, but fully edited and organized down to the end of 2020. You can find that at planetwaves.fm. It says chronology right at the very top of the page. It's a fascinating read. It's 185 pages, you will see the way this happened. So, and I'm on the air every Friday night at 10 o'clock New York time, sitting right here.
Which, yeah, we're on TNT.
Well, no. I'm going to apply to your network. No, on planetwaves.fm. Everything's closed circuit on Planet Waves.
On planetwaves.fm.
I'm not on third party platforms. Planetwaves.fm. Yep. Yeah. So I record the show during the day and then broadcast it at night, New York time.
Eric Coppolino, it has been a fantastic opportunity chatting to you. I am so glad we chatted. It is really fascinating. I think I could probably go for hours listening to you.
Anytime. Any topic. Happy to be on, really.
Yeah. Well, you're coming onto my podcast quite soon, so I'm looking forward to that as well.
Fabulous.
But it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. Thank you for joining me in the trenches. Eric Coppolino, wow, what an interesting conversation. And I've still got about a minute to go, but I will say this. It is the end of the week, and it has been a great week of learning. I love chatting to people like Eric. And let me just remind you to download the TNT app from the Android or Google App Store, as well as the Apple App Store, so that you can listen to this exact conversation hundreds of times and share it, because it's such a good conversation. Yeah. So in other words, use the digital,
yes,
the digital world.
To repeat it.
Hey, Eric.
To have it be cloned into a million places at once. Doesn't affect
your
soul.
Ironies, the ironies. Oh, I can't and deal with all these ironies.
Snap the QR code. There's the robot.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Jeff, for making everything work. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas on TNT Radio.
Bye for now.